Do we really need another computer? One that's faster, more powerful? Not everyone does. But to reinvent music using a neural processor, work off the grid with all-day battery, or bring your vision to life with AI-powered Co-Creator, then a Copilot Plus PC will make a difference. A powerful AI computer is not for everyone. But if you're trying to change the world, even if just your own, we build one for you. Microsoft Copilot Plus PCs powered by Snapdragon. The fastest, most intelligent Windows PCs ever. Battery life varies with usage and settings.
Anaconda's massive Black Friday sale is on now. Gear up for the great outdoors with up to 50% off on camping gear, bikes, water sports, fishing gear, clothing, footwear and more. Some exclusions apply. Pay less so you can play more during Anaconda's Black Friday sale.
Anaconda! We'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which this podcast was produced, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. We pay our respects to elders past and present.
It's early December 2006 and Lane Beachley has just won the World Tour title in Maui. It's the highest accolade for a surfer and a massive win for Lane. But this isn't her first time claiming the prize. She's done it six times before. This one, though, is different. It comes after 3 years of healing and determination. She's worked through adrenal fatigue, a serious neck problem, a torn ligament, and other persistent injuries to detach from fear and focus on the joy of the process. So, what does it take to stage such a phenomenal comeback and find the drive to become one of the most successful surfers of all time? I'm Matt Middleton, and this is Head Game. Today, seven-time world champion surfer, Lane Beachley. Lane Beachley, thank you so much for coming on Head Game. Now, if anyone has their head firmly in the game, it's yourself.
Thank you.
Take me back to your childhood. And when was the first time you picked up a surfboard?
Okay, so I was adopted into a beach-loving family with the last name Beachley and became a world champion surfer. So, ta-da! I was adopted by Neil and Valerie Beachley. They had a young boy called Jason, who's my older brother. And I remember going into the water before I could walk. I remember just falling in love with the sand and the beach and the sun and the surf. And then my older brother surfs, and any girl growing up with an older brother wants to be doing what he's doing, and I just do it a little bit better than he does. And I started surfing when I was about 4 years of age. I stole my brother's foamy, and I started skateboarding when I was about three and just fell in love with surfing. It was just this instant love affair. I just feel such a true connection with the ocean. It's my happy place. It's where I process my pain and heal my hurts. It's also where I learn to giggle at myself or laugh at myself. It's where I learn to surrender. It's where I learn to relinquish control. There's so many life lessons that the ocean has taught me that I'm very grateful for. But it's also a place where I experience blue health. It's where I experience true, just that, you know, that when you exhale, it's like, oh, that's how I feel.
You're home. You feel like you're home on the water. You know,
exactly.
Your ultimate peace with yourself. There's a true connection there. I get that with the mountains. That connection is truly phenomenal. It feels like that everything below the clouds in my world is, you know, is where all the noise and all the drama happens. And for those few moments that I get above the clouds, it feels like that I'm at true peace with myself. And that's what it's like when you're on the water, right?
Yeah, that's what astronauts get when they're in space. They're called the overview effect, when you get to have that observational view of life in front of you and ahead of you and behind you and around you, and you get to choose how you respond to that. You can stay in that peaceful state, or you can go into solutions mode or reflection or whatever you want to do. But, yes, it's that homecoming is a beautiful state of relaxation and connectedness and centeredness. And that's why I crave being in the ocean every day. But it also makes you feel, I don't know how about you feel, Ant, when you're sitting on top of that mountain, it almost, there's an element of me that feels insignificant in that moment as well.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Just like, in your words, probably a tiny drop in the ocean.
Yeah, a water drop.
So you say you were born into an adoptive family. Did you have communication with your birth mother? Was there a relationship there, or was it just a complete separation and you were just bomb into this adoptive family, surfboards, skateboards, and away you went?
Yeah, so back in 1972 when I was born, the rules around adoption were very different and there wasn't really much communication. It had to be initiated either by the child or the parent once the child was old enough to understand or follow through with that. Fortunately, my biological mother didn't veto communication like a lot of parents did back in those days. There was a lot of shame around being an unwed teenager to become pregnant and then give birth. There was moments where she, I don't think, wanted to keep me. There was moments when she did want to keep me, and then there was plenty of moments when she wasn't allowed to keep me. So fortunately, I wasn't aborted. I was adopted, and I was thrust into your midi-crib because I was 6 weeks early as a premature baby. And I know mum, because I've had the opportunity to connect with my biological mother later in my life when I was 27, when it was when I first met her. And when I interviewed her for my book, I wrote a biography back in 2009 called Beneath the Waves, and where she shared the story about how she really wanted to, you know, reach in and grab me. And long story short, she wasn't allowed to keep me. She was 17. She was an unwed Scottish woman growing up in Surrey Hills and Sydney suburbs, and her parents were quite religious. And so, yeah, I was put up for adoption from birth, but because I was 6 weeks premature, I had to fight for my life for a few weeks in a humidicrib. And then, then I was adopted by the Beachley family.
Wow, fighting from the go-get, from the start. Fight straight out of there, do you know what? Boom, let's do it. Let's do this.
That's the story I tell myself. Because if I reflect on it honestly, look, I was just a baby doing the baby thing. I
of don't course, really know yeah, exactly.
Fighting, it's a good story.
Yeah, I love it. Use it. Yeah. So you're born into this adoptive family, and the life is just normal for you, right? Like you said, you're having fun, and you're learning from your brothers, I take it. So, you know, the surfboards, the outdoors activity, the Beachley family are like you said, are very outdoorsy and Beachley, shall we say. So you've got a great childhood growing up.
I do, yeah. So I was fortunate that I grew up with the freedom to roam and the freedom to explore. We didn't have mobile phones, and if you broke the law, your parents actually sided with the police, not, you know, defending you. And what I loved about my childhood is the only rule was that I had to be home before the streetlights came on. And so if I was out on the streets after the streetlights came on, then I was going to be in serious trouble. So there, I would just found my tribe. And fortunately, I found a really good tribe of guys that I grew up surfing with, and I spent a lot of time at the beach hanging with those guys. You know, they were my protectors, my providers, my supporters, my cheerleaders, my honesty barometers, and they gave me a lot of shit but taught me to give a lot of it back. And I reflect on it and think, you know, when people were giving me a hard time, it was actually because they cared about me.
Yeah.
And they respected Absolutely. Me, and they knew that I had more to give, and so they prided themselves on challenging me, and I took it, and it taught me to give it back, but it also taught me resilience and compassion, and I wish it taught me empathy, but it didn't. You know,
not until later on in your years where you start to go, right, listen, yeah, I suppose empathy is, you know, something that, you know, comes with age and maturity. It's, you know, especially in such a competitive organization or such a competitive sport, you know, empathy is sort of like pushed right to the back, isn't it? It's like, just get on the surfboard, suck it up, go and ride your wave. Just like with me, pick up your weapon, get onto the battlefield, suck it up, deal with what you have to deal with. And you sort of learn to sort of block that emotion off, don't you? You learn to sort of hide that away.
It's called survival mode. Yeah, when you block mm-hmm. it out, you're literally just in this survival mentality where you're just doing everything that you think you need to do to not only survive, but obviously in our situations, we wanted to thrive. You know, we wanted to be victorious. We wanted to win. We wanted to be standing at the top of the mountain. And that takes every part of you to do that. It takes a lot of commitment, a lot of sacrifice, a lot of compromise, some really heavy decisions, a lot of boundaries. And fortunately, I think with the military, I think about the military and, you know, some of the stories that you share, especially in your book, and I think about how that can kind of correlates a little bit with surfing, because structure creates freedom. And when we have all those structures around us, it gives us the authority to do what we want to do. But the minute we lose that structure, we lose that freedom, and then we lose our boundaries, and then we lose a sense of ourselves. We lose our identity and our sense of belonging, and that creates a whole nother undoing to then rebuild from there again.
Absolutely. We're 100% right. And there is similarities, especially with elite sports people, elite athletes. So like there's that discipline and structure that you need in your life, and you need to be disciplined, self-disciplined with yourself in order to maintain that structure, right? It's about that consistency of that discipline. Were your parents growing up, were they very supportive? Were your adoptive mum and dad, if you like, mum, yeah, were they always pushing you on? Were they quite, or were they just like quite happy just to let you crack on with things?
They were happy for me to just crack on with what I wanted to do. I was a real tomboy. I loved being outside. I loved playing. And I played in a bunch of different sports. And my mum, who adopted me, her beautiful name was Valerie, she passed away when I was 6 years of age. She had a brain hemorrhage on the operating table during a cosmetic surgery procedure, which was simply devastating. And so,
do you remember that moment? Do you remember? Is young, I know, but I lost my father when I was 5, and I can remember it. You know, I can remember the moment of realizing that my dad isn't here anymore, and that was 5. But 6 is obviously a year later. Was that quite a turning point in your life as a youngster?
Yeah, I think I'm pretty sure you would say yes. It's a pivotal moment, and at that age, it's really impactful due to a variety of different things. But, you know, we're talking about the head game. Our brain waves have shifted by the time that we're 6 years of age, and we've gone basically from being narcissists to now being judgmental and critical and analytical. So now everything's happening to me, and now I'm going to project back onto the world what I make of that. And as a six-year-old, I feel I was quite an immature six-year-old. So I remember Dad coming home and telling me that Mum's gone forever and she's never coming back. And I remember feeling that deep sense of sadness and loss and feeling distressed. And I remember putting my head in my pillow and bawling my eyes out. And then I just remember connecting with the feeling and feeling so uncomfortable that I thought, what can I do to shift this? And I jumped on my skateboard and I ran to the top of the hill and I rode down it as fast as I possibly could. And I just kept doing that just to break the sadness.
That's very interesting. So were you doing it in a reckless type of way? Were you, or because I had a similar moment where I had a sort of a road next to me, and I wouldn't play chicken with the cars, but I'd cross it and I'd keep crossing it with my brothers because we lived in the countryside. Was it something that you just done, or was it just was it something that you just wanted to do to express yourself, really, you know, to push yourself to try and get some anger and some frustration out?
I don't recall being reckless, but then women, we tend to be a little bit more self-preserving because we are responsible for keeping the population going. So we tend to be a little less reckless. Maybe we're more calculating in our recklessness.
That's a good way of putting it. Yeah.
I've been going up and down that hill for a couple of years prior to that moment. But I do remember perhaps just pushing myself just that little bit more to go that little bit faster, to feel the wind in my hair and the breeze on my face and just to feel something other than sadness. So why do you think you were playing chicken recklessly with cars? What were you wanting to feel?
I just think it was just, you know, you're sort of a way of trying to, because you can't really explain what you're feeling at that age, can you? You know, you explain it through your actions, I suppose.
Yeah.
And even though, you know, it was an exciting thing that we'd done before, but I can remember doing it after with, I wouldn't say not a care in the world, but a bit more like, you know, if anything did happen, then, you know, what's the point? Yeah, you know, my dad's not here. Like you said, you project it back onto the world, right?
Yeah.
So it's, and that's why I just mentioned that, because, you know, it was a way of just expressing yourself in that moment. So, like you said, to get the sadness out or to get the frustration away, or being able to sort of express yourself in a way that you couldn't verbally, or you couldn't speak to someone, or that you do it through your actions, right?
Yeah.
And you being super active. I was wondering if that was just a moment that you remember, hence why you spoke about it, because it could have been quite a prominent point in your life.
It was very prominent. If you go back to that five-year-old, can you reflect on what it is that you were wanting to say?
Yeah, I just wanted to understand the situation, what went on, you know, the questions that you couldn't ask, you know, how did my father pass? Why isn't he here? You know, what went wrong? What could have prevented that from happening? And, you know, my father passed of a heart attack. So it was, and he's completely healthy, played a lot of rugby, you know, so it was, you know, all these questions as a youngster, I suppose, that you only express through actions, and, you know, hence why people go, such a naughty child, or it's probably not, it's just the people expressing themselves. And it just hit a nerve when you said about going up and down that hill, because I was like, I used to sort of run up and run across the road in a way that just took me back to that moment. God, so in a way, at that stage, you've not lost your birth mum, but you've lost two mums at that stage, because obviously I know you didn't meet your birth mum until later on in the years, but then your adoptive mum passed away. God, that's like two losses in a matter of six, seven years.
Yeah, well, the thing was that I didn't know I'd lost two mothers at that stage. I only know I'd lost one. And then when my dad decided to tell me I was adopted, I was 8 years of age, and that was the biggest catalyst moment in my life, because I felt so rejected in that moment. Irrespective of how beautiful he was in communicating his truth to me around, you know, I'm your baby girl. He would say, you're my baby girl and you belong here and we love you and we've always wanted a girl within this family, but you're not a blood relation. And the minute I heard that, I'm like, uh-oh, I don't belong here. I am not from this family. I am not of blood relation. So where do I come from? Who do I belong to? Why am I here? Where is my mother? And why didn't you want me?
Yes. Do you think you were too young to take that information in?
We're never too young to take in information, ever. We're never too young to take in honest communication and truth. And, you know, we do it. I see a lot of parents say or do or behave in a way to protect their children, but all they're doing is literally protecting their own emotional state. You know, you're not protecting your children by lying to them. You're protecting yourself.
And you said that was a huge moment in your life, right?
Yeah.
Huge moment.
Yeah, it was painful.
And how did you deal with that moving forward?
Set a goal to become a world champion.
Do you know what? Wow. What a goal to set yourself. It's bizarre, because when people go through a lot of trauma, or they go through, you know, traumatic experiences or experiences that really change their life in the moment, a purpose and a goal, you know, and then I know it sounds a bit cliche, but it really does help you focus that aggression, that frustration, that misunderstanding onto something and direct it onto a goal or onto a purpose that you're truly passionate about. And it's people like yourselves that have been through that end up high achievers, because they've managed to bundle it all together and go, right, I've got this purpose now. I've got this goal that I need to achieve, and I'm going to do it for my mum. I'm going to do it for the family. I'm going to do it for whatever the reason is for that purpose. When was the first time that you realized that actually I'm freaking good at what I do, and I'm going to make a living out of this, and I am actually going to become a world champion?
Well, firstly, I want to reflect on what you just said in regards to channeling your energy, because it's 100% right. We choose to channel our energy, our focus, our emotions into something. I'd say the most successful people and the biggest misfits have all been through trauma. But it's how we choose to respond to it. And some of us choose to become victims while others choose to become victors. And I was really fortunate that I had I don't know if you've read Malcolm Gladwell's book, Outliers.
No, I haven't.
But
no.
He refers to three things that contribute to success. And number one is an opportunity. Number two is ability. And number three is an arbitrary advantage. And if I think about how those three things played into my ultimate success, I mean, I had the opportunity to grow up with a surf-loving family. I had the ability to stand on a surfboard, and I had the arbitrary advantage to be close to Manly Beach. So I had consistent access to the environment that I loved to be in. So those things really contributed or gave me a head start to the success that I ultimately craved. When I set the goal to become a world champion, at the time it was rather ambiguous. I wanted to be a world champion cricket player, soccer player, hockey player, tennis player, surfer, like all the sports that I was participating in. I just wanted to be a world champion. So one thing I never relied on was making a living from being a world champion. I've never been money focused. I've never been driven by money. I've never really focused on what I can make. It's almost about not only what I can get, but what I can give. And that's
and achieve.
Yeah, what can I achieve, and therefore then pass on to the next generation? So that ended up falling into the surfing bucket, because I never had that moment where I'm like, I'm really good at this. I'm going to make a living from this. Because the first thing that came to mind when you asked that question was, The first moment where I felt I can do this was actually when I came dead last in the first contest I ever competed in. It's counterintuitive, really, isn't it?
No, but it's, again, it's that drive, right? It's that you just wanted to get better and better and better. And
it didn't discourage me.
Take me back to that moment. Take me back to that competition or that tournament. And, you know, because that's that, again, you know, that's hugely inspirational. You know, if you come last it and you think, wow, this is what I want to do. That's quite a different mindset. Why? It's a different approach into tackling your purpose or your goals. Yep. I love that.
And I still apply it to this day. So when I reflect back on that moment, I was 14. I had just progressed from a foamy to a fiberglass surfboard. I'd been literally riding on a foamy for about 9 or 10 years. And so I'd spent about a year on this fiberglass board. And I'm like, all right, I'm good enough to go and compete. And fortunately, it was just like a charity event. It wasn't any significant contest that would contribute to any kind of world ranking or anything like that. And I was so nervous that my surfboard felt like a block of cement. I just couldn't do a turn. I was so nervous. It was horrible. And I was so disappointed in myself. I'm like, Lane, you know how to do better. Come on. You can do this.
Come on, gal. What's wrong with you? Get a grip of yourself.
What's wrong with me was that I was, you know, worried about what people were thinking, worried about failing, worried about not being good enough. You know, all those external circumstances that really discourage us and distract us from being the best that we can be. And after that performance, I came in, I took off my rash vest, I almost threw it on the sand. I was like, this is bullshit. I know I can surf better than this. And then I paddled out and I surfed for the next couple of hours just to prove to myself that I know that I can surf better. And then that encouraged me to go, okay, I need to train harder, I need to focus more, I need to spend more time working on my equipment. And it just made me channel my attention into becoming a better surfer. And at the time, I was competing in cricket and tennis. And there's a wonderful acronym that I live by, which is the word focus, follow one course until successful. We can get so distracted by all the other courses that we've been told that we're supposed to follow that we don't follow them. And in the end, we kind of do everything half-assed. And that's what I was doing with my surfing life. I was being half-assed. And then when I reflect on everything that I've become successful at over the last 50 years of my life, I was absolutely abysmally appalling at every single one of them the first time I did it. I came dead last in the surfing event. The first time I did a live TV show, I had stage fright. I was literally like a mute staring at the camera going, holy shit, what is this?
I've been there 100%, right? 100%. But it's that fright, it's that fear that actually, well, for people like us, I suppose once we learn how to make it work for us, and once we learn how to harness our fears and our emotions, it excites us. You know, I the same when I used to go on to public speaking, I used to go, but then because I was frightened, it almost challenged me, right? You've got to, you know, get over this hurdle. You've got to, you know, you can turn around and go back, but that's not you, Ant. You know, and you're exactly right when you say that. And I love the acronym focus, follow one course until successful. Wow, I love that. I absolutely love that. I'm going to steal it off of you and I'm going to use it. Thank you.
At Priceline Pharmacy, you can gift more for less this Christmas with Max Factor's makeup range half price, including the Divine Lashes Clean Renovation Rich Black. Feel great, celebrate at Priceline Pharmacy.
With UniSuper, greater value super comes from over 40 years of thinking great. Awarded Canstar's outstanding value 3 years running. UniSuper's in-house investment team drives lower fees, meaning more of your earnings push toward your tomorrow. Every Australian can join a super fund that values a future worth retiring for at unisuper.com.au. Look forward. Think great. Consider UniSuper Limited's PDS and TMD on its website and your circumstances before making decisions, because we haven't.
So you come last in this tournament, but you feel like that actually I belong here. I can do better. This is my first tournament. Now it's just egged you on even more.
Yep. And then so the following year I competed again, but I went back to the drawing board and I worked on my fitness and my surfing technique and, you know, improve my equipment and just do those little things, you know, those one percenters that we always talk about in the world. And then I won a regional scholastic event. So I was literally competing against girls around my age group in this particular area, the Northern Beaches. And
what,
I won
16,
that
17,
15,
16, 17, 15.
Yeah.
Wow. And you win this tournament.
Yeah.
So you go from last, to first.
Yes.
You don't do things by halves, do you?
No, I don't. So then I win another one. And then 2 years later, I join the Pro Tour and go back to dead last again. Like event after event after event after. It's like the first five events on the Pro Tour came dead last. Whew, wow. That was hard.
So you hit pro at what age?
18.
So you hit pro at 18. You surf competition after competition, and you come last on five, did you say?
Five. The first five I ever competed in, yes.
After the second, third one, fourth one, what mindset, different mindset did you have to think, right, listen, I'm just going to learn, go on and keep doing it until I progress?
Look, I had a classic victimized mentality. It was everyone else's bloody fault. It was everyone else's fault, not mine. So yeah. In actual fact, I had a very fixed mindset. I had very little belief. I was incredibly insecure. I had very little confidence. I was comparing myself to my competition, which made me feel inadequate. And I really lacked the concentration and the focus to get the job done. If anything, I was incredibly distracted, like highly distracted. And because I was comparing and judging and criticizing and being a victim, my performance was a direct reflection of my beliefs. So when you say, well, where was your self-belief? There was none, obviously, because my results were a direct reflection of that, because our lives are a direct reflection of what we believe to be about ourselves. And I had this overt arrogance about me, but I was blind to my own arrogance. And it took my dream team of people around me to pull my head in and say, you actually need to get your head back in the game. In actual fact, you also need to get your heart back into the game as well, because your ego is fueling your behaviors. You are not good enough to be here. You have a lot of work to do. And are you willing to do it? And so then I basically looked at all the world champions around me and went, all right, well, each one of those people who I respect, by the way, I only chose athletes that I respected, they each have something that I want. And when you surround yourself with experts, you shortcut the struggle. So I went up to the fittest world champion on tour and I said, Tom and Wendy, how are you so fit? Who do you work with? They introduced me to their personal trainer. Pauline, you've gone from zero to hero. Who was your surf coach? She introduced me to her surf coach. How do you, I was just tapping into the knowledge and experience.
Asking questions, right?
Asking questions.
Getting out there and asking question upon, that's what I say to my children, that's what I say to everyone, adults, ask questions. People are afraid to ask questions. It's like, go up there, chew that person's ear off, ask those questions, get that knowledge. And it's interesting that you say, it's a state of mind ultimately. And I always say the state of your life is a reflection of your state of mind. Mm. And, if you believe that you're not good enough, you're not going to be good enough. If you believe that, if you make excuses, then you're always going to be chasing your tail. My equipment's not good enough. This isn't good enough. But asking those questions and surrounding yourself with positive people that have been there and done it's a game changer, right?
It is. But then did you believe in yourself before you actually achieved the outcome?
No.
No, you don't, do you?
No.
Learning how to lose taught me how to win.
Yeah,
it absolutely. Took me a lot of losses to learn how to lose properly.
Absolutely. It's that fear of failure, right? People don't commit because they look at they go, right, for example, yourself, professional losses, two, three, four, God, talk about looking at the next tournament. You're like probably looking at it going, right, I'm going to fail, but guess what? I'm going to commit anyway. Cause when I commit, I'm going to learn something and I'm going to grow from it. And I'm going to collect those percentages along the way. But it takes a certain willpower and a certain mindset to do that. Mm. And to be able to go out and then sort of chew the ear off of the people that were winning. All right, tell me how you've done this. Tell me
how
you've done that.
So annoyed.
Yeah, I bet they were. But it also takes a humbling mindset as well to be able to go, do you know what? I've got to put my ego aside because things aren't working out. And I've got to humble myself in order to go, right, this person's better than me. This person's, because at that age, it's hard to be able to do that. So a lot of people, they normally take a back step and go, right, this isn't for me. But you just completely flipped it on its head, right?
Yep.
And you were like, right, tell me how you done this, tell me how you done that. Yep. And when was the first time you came out victorious in your pro career?
So I joined the tour in 1990 and the first event that I won was in 1993.
Wow.
And then the first world title was in 1998. So it took me 8 years to win a world title and 3 years to win an event.
See, people don't realize, you know, the losses, the failures, the setbacks, the knockbacks, the dents in confidence. And then all of a sudden to that turning point of winning that first competition, what did that feel like?
Oh my gosh. Incredibly humbling, satisfying, rewarding, exciting, overwhelming. Like, yeah, I committed every ounce of my being into winning that event. I remember walking out of the water and just bawling my eyes out. Just going, I can't believe I've just done that. This is amazing. And then the next day I was right back at work at the surf shop.
And after that victory, do you remember your first world title?
My first world title, yes, of course I remember that, because that's what I'd set my sights on. Since my dad told me I was adopted as an 8-year-old, I set my sights on becoming a world champion. Then when I lost in that first event as a 14-year-old, I set my sights on becoming a world champion surfer. So to fulfill that ambition and to have set that, you know, I put that stake in the sand at a very young age, and that really discourages people, or it intimidates and threatens people when you're so single-minded and so focused and so driven. But then it also helps you collate, it helps you gravitate towards the people that are going to help you achieve it. So when I won that first world title, I felt an immense sense of relief and satisfaction, and I'm sure all my peers were as relieved as I was, because they were tired of hearing me talk about it. You know, here I was claiming that I was going to be
like,
a world champion.
Shut up. Just go out there and do it.
Shut up. And then I win it, and they're like, thank God. Yay. Yeah.
Did it change your life?
The most significant change around me was people's perspective of me changed. So now my responsibility as a role model, as a world champion, has changed into someone that must be more respectful and must be worthy of admiration and must be a role model. We're not taught any of this stuff. We're just thrust into it the minute we stand on a podium with a trophy above our heads. And now all of a sudden, when I'm normally quite sardonic or sarcastic, that's now taken as being disrespectful and insulting. It's like, I'm still me, but now I'm not allowed to be me. You must know what that means.
Listen, I just ignore it all. I'm just like, listen, you're going to have to put up with me. You're going to have to put up with me, like it or lump it. And a lot of people like it. Some people don't. So what?
And what does that say about them?
Yeah, do you know what? It's exactly that. You're almost throwing the problem back at them. It's not your problem. But it is because you get thrust into a world, don't you, that you know, that you, now the eyes are on you, every, you know, the pressure's on you. Like you said about being a role model, you're expected to act and behave in a certain way. And it's like, I just want to get on and do what I do best. How did you deal with that? How did you cope with that? Because
that's exactly
what happens. No?
No, because I attempted to stay the same, and that wasn't accepted any longer. So then I had
It's crazy that.
Isn't it? So I had to change the way I communicated, the way that I bantered, the way that I showed up. I now realize that as a public personality that I'm not permitted to have a bad day. However I go out is I have to put on the happy face and put on the smile, and irrespective of what's going on in my life, it doesn't matter, because the 10 seconds that you get with me will determine whether you like me or not. Not that I care, but I do.
Yeah, yeah, of course. No, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's something that emotionally and psychologically, on top of trying to maintain your titles, or trying to do what you love doing and what you're very talented at doing, the psychological and emotional pressure of that, it does affect you. You know, people say, oh, you're very good at, you know, putting it aside, but you do take it in with you, because all of a sudden you realize it's almost you've got a burning sensation on the back of your head. You're realizing that there's eyes on you 24/7, you know, even when you're out surfing, you're out in it. How did that affect you moving on to, let's say, into your next tournament? Because now the pressure's on, you're this world champion, and they expect you to go out there and do it again. They expect you to perform. And if you don't, guess what? They're going to be on you.
Of course. Well, they're on me anyway. But the thing is that no one can expect more of me than I expect of myself. So once I got that understanding, I was able to detach myself from external expectations. But that took a lot of work. In the meantime, I was weighed down by expectation. I was now suffering from injuries because I was being absolutely a hard ass. I was being unrelenting. I was really pushing myself unnecessarily too hard. I was unacceptable. Well, look, yeah, it was. I made things a lot harder than they needed to be. Then I pushed people away who were wanting to help me, who were wanting to support me. And then I literally, I surrounded myself. Well, I put myself in a little bubble. I was like, you don't understand. You're just attacking me because you want what I've got. And yeah, so I became a little bit maybe vicious, or I just lacked compassion. I lacked empathy. I lacked understanding. I wasn't really equipped for it, but I did the best that I could with what I knew.
But there is an element of that, because when you hit success like that, you do, you got to think about, you become intimidating, you become a threat, you know, whether that's to, you know, to what you say or what you do or what you, you know, to your competitors. So you naturally take on that, you know, because you are successful and you're extremely good at what you do. You are intimidating, you are a threat without even realizing, without even giving off that persona. People look at you like that because they think, right.
But in saying that, Ant, that's a story that you're projecting onto me. So it's not something that I see myself as. Like, I'm just here wiping the slate clean, wanting to come back and do it again. But I'm still doing all the work that I did last year. Actually, I'm doing twice as much work because I'm expecting myself to be twice as good to earn the right to win again. But you're now saying, oh, I'm a threat. I'm an intimidation because I've got what you want. But that's your story. That's not my story. We now point at someone and say, well, now you've got what I want, and now you're in my way of that. So no, I only see you as a threat. I don't see you as a peer or just a competitor or a friend. I see you more as a foe and a threat, and get the hell out of my way.
It's true though, isn't it? Yeah. It's true. It's quite phenomenal, because then you have to sort of, your mindset is naturally pulled from left to right. Your emotions are everywhere. So what year was the first one that you won?
I won my first world title in 1998, and then I decided that I needed to do it again and again and again and again and again. So my boyfriend at the time was a guy called Ken Bradshaw. He looks a lot like Buzz Lightyear, and he saw more in me than I saw in myself. He was my safety, my sounding board, my coach, my mentor, my lover, my best friend. I basically
put everything wrapped into one.
Yep. So he basically said, look, you're the best surfer in the world. I believe that you could be the best of the best. And so we looked at the history books. Lisa Anderson was the first female to win four consecutive world titles. And Kelly Slater had won five consecutive world titles. So I decided that I needed to set my sights on becoming a six times consecutive world title.
I could see what was going on in your head back then. Absolutely. I would have been the same. So yeah. You've got that first world title. Because I suppose once you pick up your second, third, fourths, is it hard not to get complacent, or does it just push you on even more? Because obviously you said about the four titles with the women's, Kelly Slater having five. So was your goal to get six to be the
to beat Kelly,
the top consecutive? Yeah, to beat Kelly. Was that a goal of yours?
So yes, that was the goal. But now, upon reflection, having done the work and having the courage to look in the mirror, I realized that the goal was not to become the most successful surfer in – well, look, the goal was to become the most successful surfer in history, which means winning six consecutive world titles, which no other surfer in the history of the sport has done. However, the ultimate objective was really self-worth. Like, I just wanted to feel worthy of love. That's all I wanted, because the story that I told myself as an eight-year-old, that I've been abandoned and rejected and I'm undeserving of love, and therefore the parameter that I'd placed around that is, if the only way that I can be worthy of love is if I become the most successful in the world at something. And I decided that surfing was the formula. And so when I became the most successful surfer in the world, having won six consecutive world titles, one of my best friends asked me, so – literally, you know, are you enough yet? Like, what's driving you? Is it because you're adopted? And I went, oh. Yeah, actually. So what I'm really striving for is that worthiness, that feeling of self-worth and self-love and self-acceptance. So am I enough now? Do I have that yet? Like, when am I going to choose to accept that?
At Priceline Pharmacy, you can gift more for less this Christmas with the Sally Hansen Nail Range half price, including the three-step system which features the Miracle Gel Grip Primer, Miracle Gel Nail Color Gelibrate, and Miracle Gel Top Coat. Feel great, celebrate at Priceline Pharmacy.
With UniSuper, greater value super comes from over 40 years of thinking great. Awarded Canstar's outstanding value 3 years running. UniSuper's in-house investment team drives lower fees, meaning more of your earnings push toward your tomorrow. Every Australian can join a super fund that values a future worth retiring for at unisuper.com.au. Look forward. Think great. Consider UniSuper Limited's PDS and TMD on its website and your circumstances before making decisions, because we haven't.
You mentioned that you got back in touch with your birth mother when you were 27, I believe you said. Was that during the period when you were winning these consecutive titles?
Yeah, it was right before I won my second one.
Right, so right at the beginning of this journey. And did that help you?
No, it was a distraction.
Do you reach out to her, or does she reach out to you?
She reached out to me, and she found out who my dad was. So she called my dad, and then dad told her that I was traveling through Indonesia. I didn't tell her what I did. And then she must have somehow found out and found my phone number. And he said to her, I have given Lane your number, and it's in her court to call you. So you just wait. But she didn't wait. So she ended up calling me and essentially tried to make up for 27 years in the first 10 minutes of a phone call. And it was a little too much for me to handle. And so it kick-started on a tumultuous note and just rode those waves for many years. You know, she came to events unannounced. She connected with friends. But you know what? I was keeping her at arm's distance because I was protecting myself. And all I was doing actually was hurting her, because I thought that I wasn't ready to allow her into my life. And what I didn't realize until after I interviewed her for my book was that I equated motherhood with loss, because at the time, my dad had remarried to a beautiful woman called Christina. She had her and dad had another daughter. So I had a baby sister who's 18 years younger than me, called Catherine. And at the time when I met my mum, she was dealing with breast cancer. And she'd gone into remission, and then 3 years later, she died from breast cancer. So when I met my mum and she told me she was HIV positive, I was like, oh, great. Well, it's just another, you know, it's just a matter of time until you're dead too. And then she died 5 years ago from ovarian cancer. So I've lost three mothers in the space of, you know, 45 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, three mothers. Car. But what really fascinates me, Lane, is that you still managed to win six world titles thereafter. So
put you the talk about on a you know how to yeah, do
I
that,
know, I know. But you talk about a distraction, but, you know, maybe, and again, you know, hindsight is great. If you didn't have, then you maybe even not have gone on to win all these world, you know, it might have been a positive. It might have given you a bit more drive somewhere, or a bit more focus somewhere, or a bit more something to prove, maybe just to, I don't know, but to go on and win six titles thereafter, you know, I don't think distraction was it, you know, you can look at it like that, but maybe it actually gave you a different focus or a different drive in a way that you didn't realize was happening.
Well, look, there's healthy distractions and there's unhealthy distractions. And at times, mum was an unhealthy distraction, and sometimes she was actually a healthy distraction. I think ultimately my intrinsic motivation was much stronger than anything extrinsic. So it didn't matter what I was, you know, seeking or yearning for extrinsically, because intrinsically I was that compassionateless tiger shark. I was on this relentless pursuit of success because I lacked self-worth. And then when I won my sixth one, I'm like, ah, oh, okay, I'm worthy now. And then I thought, all right, let's go on and win a seventh.
So you win your sixth one, then you have a bit of a break. How long after does the seventh title come?
So in 2003 is when I won my sixth one. And then in 2004, I take probably about 6 weeks off, and then I come back. Now I've got adrenal fatigue, mental exhaustion, my body is breaking down, and I'm like, I don't care. I've got another world title to win. Let's go for seven. You've still got it, Beachley. You can do this. And then halfway through the year, I was surfing in Fiji in Cloudbreak, and was trying to prove something. And I don't know if you've ever heard of an author called Louise Hay. She wrote the book called You Can Heal Your Life. And essentially she talks about how physical pain has an emotional component to it, and you need to deal with the emotion to then process the physical. And every different part of your body pertains to a different style of belief or emotion. But essentially, your knees represent your ego. So if you're always hurting your knees, it's either you're showing off, or you're trying to prove something, or you're pushing past your own limitations and you're hurting your knees all the time. So I was trying to prove to myself that I could barrel ride properly on my backhand. And of course, it was a small day and I was fatigued and I got clipped in the back of the head and I went over the falls and I tore my medial ligament and my meniscus in my right knee. So that took me out for the next few events and, of course, compromised my ability to compete for the world title.
How hard was that for someone as active and as driven as you to take time? And this is for anyone that's injured or, you know, that's at the top of their game that gets injured. How hard is it to actually sit back and heal correctly?
At the time, it was really hard. I didn't want to accept it, and I just kept trying to push through it. And here's another thing that may resonate with you is the body whispers before it screams. And the body was whispering to me, but I was not listening. I didn't listen until it was screaming at me. And even then, I was pushing through it. Like, I've got a knee brace on, and I'm still trying to compete. You know, just kept pushing to the point where the body went, enough, no more. So I had to take time out, and it taught me the nature of acceptance, but it was a short-lived lesson because then the following year I went and pushed again and like, okay, I'm back. You know, I've won another event. I'm back and, you know, I'm still in the top five. I can do this. and I had a really severe injury in 2001. I was surfing at Chopu. I won the contest at Chopu in Tahiti. And on my last wave, got a little bit arrogant and came out of the barrel with my eyes down. Now, surfing is a great analogy for life. Where you look is where you go. And I looked down, so the nose of my board went down into the impact zone of the lip of the wave. Now, the lip of the wave in Tahiti is three times as the thickness of a regular wave. So it hit the back of my neck, herniated a disc, my left arm went numb, and I just chose to ignore it. And I surfed with immeasurable pain for the next 5 years. And then in 2005, which was when I was competing for my seventh world title, the second time, I was doing a photo shoot. I put my board down. Something snapped between my shoulder blades. I went and got an MRI, and it showed that 80% of my spinal cord was severed from this herniated disc. And I was still trying to compete, still trying to surf, still trying to train. I went to Alaska for a surf trip, and I couldn't even hold my head up because the wetsuits were so thick. I had a foam wedge pad in my wetsuit just to hold my head up.
I think this interview has just confirmed that you are indeed crazy.
Lunatic, yes.
Lunatic. There we go. That's what we've got from this interview. That's it. Yeah. Right. Lainey, you are officially a lunatic.
Lainey's a lunatic, yeah. So I pushed and pushed and pushed. And so that was one of the toughest times I had to spend out of the water. I was out of the water for almost six months. And because of the knee injury and how hard it was to come back from that, I really feel that kind of set the motions in stone, or it was the predicator to me being accepting of the fact that, okay, my body is broken. I need to heal. So the same level of intensity and focus that I invest into training and preparation and competition, I now need to refocus and rechannel that into healing my body. And so I adopted so many different healing modalities. I was told to get surgery and I was told to retire. Neither of those appealed to me. So I went and got a third piece of advice. And he said, you're 33, you're young, you're fit, you're strong, but it's going to take time. And you have to give it as much time as you can. So I missed the last few events of the year and I was not allowed to surf or train. I was in immense pain for a long time, but I just did everything that I had to do to allow my body to heal itself. So that meant taking everything inflammatory out of my diet. No sugar, no dairy, no alcohol, no wheat, no fun.
Discipline, right? Reverting back to discipline. Yeah.
Yeah. Channeled that energy from competition into healing my body.
Getting back on a board, basically.
Yeah. And that was the objective.
The basics.
Yep. the ultimate goal was to be able to surf without pain. I didn't set the goal to come back and win another world title. I just wanted to be able to come and compete or even just surf without pain. And then after about 6 months, I just, it was almost like I woke up and went, feels all right today. Yeah.
This works. This is working.
I can look to the left and the right. Okay, this is good.
And what was it like winning that seventh world title?
It was the most gratifying. I was so grateful. So instead of winning in fear, I won in ease, grace, and gratitude. When I wasn't winning, I was learning, and it was really valuable life lessons that I was able to take and go, okay, that's really good. Let's reflect on the past for just a moment. Learn from that. Let that go. Let's apply it to the next one. And when I kept doing that, my results kept coming because I wasn't bringing the shit from yesterday into the beauty of today. And so, therefore, I wasn't sabotaging my next opportunities. I was actually just letting it go and moving on. And so it was a really effortless world title to win. Of course, there were their challenges and setbacks and obstacles and sicknesses. And, you know, I even staged the richest surfing event in the world that year. I put a lot of other expectations and responsibilities on my shoulders throughout that year. But to be able to win it in emphatic fashion out at 10-foot Honolulu Bay in some of the most perfect waves in the world, it was incredibly satisfying and rewarding. And I think you can obviously tell from the energy in which I speak about it how much that world title means to me.
I love that. I love that you got that sevenfold title, you know, through love and acceptance. And, you know, that's absolutely phenomenal. And I've learned so much from you. I know the listeners are going to learn so much from you. But before I leave you, you've got the Awake Academy.
I do.
Talk to me a bit about the Awake Academy, because this is now, you spoke at the very beginning of this podcast about giving back, you know, that purpose. You didn't do it for the money. You done it, you know, to for self-worth. And then now you're at that stage where, you know, your experience, your knowledge, everything that you've got, you give back. And is that why you started the Awake Academy?
100% nailed it, Ant. Yes. So as a motivational speaker, we stand up on stage and we deliver so much content and so many messages. And then it's almost like we vomit on our audience and then like drop the mic and walk out. And they're left going, wait.
Where's the continuation to this?
Yeah, exactly. So I created the Awake Academy to help people feel more centered, connected, and confident in themselves. And it's my life lessons distilled into a 7-round online course that helps people become more aware of their feelings and ability to process them, more aligned with themselves and their dream team of people, and then awaken their soul to play more, to celebrate success, to celebrate failure, to bring more vitality and health and well-being into their lives. So, yeah, it's all the things that I've learned from all the different modalities and coaches and leaders and legends that I've worked with throughout my whole career. And it's an online self-empowerment platform to help people not only know themselves but grow themselves.
Ah, Lena, absolutely love that. Listen, I'm going to be checking it out for sure. Thank you so much for coming on to my podcast. I've learned a lot, as I've said. I've never surfed before in my life.
Well, let me teach you.
And I like to think that my balance is pretty good. So with the right teacher and the positive people around, I'll be sure to hit you up. But thanks for coming on. Amazing accolades, amazing career, and it's great that you're giving back. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Ant.
Thanks so much for joining me on Head Game. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure you're subscribed so you don't miss any of our incredible stories, and leave me a review wherever you're listening. I'm Ant Middleton. Catch you again next time.
At Priceline Pharmacy, you can gift more for less this Christmas by saving 30% off the number 7 skincare range, which includes the Future Renew Serum exclusive to Priceline. Feel great, celebrate at Priceline Pharmacy.
With UniSuper, greater value super comes from over 40 years of thinking great. Awarded Canstar's outstanding value 3 years running. UniSuper's in-house investment team drives lower fees, meaning more of your earnings push toward your tomorrow. Every Australian can join a super fund that values a future worth retiring for at unisuper.com.au. Look forward. Think great. Consider UniSuper Limited's PDS and TMD on its website and your circumstances before making decisions, because we haven't.